And in any other way, you know, if you were practicing with a gun or a bow or whatever, you practice and you practice and you practice and you try to get good, and you aim for the target and you try to hit the spot where you're aiming. I remember in college, my wife and I took a archery class together, and one day in particular, we were shooting at the target, and she got all excited. She's not the greatest archer in the world. And she got a bullseye, and she was jumping up and down, "Dan! Dan! I got a bullseye! I got a bullseye!" And I looked really close, and I said, "Yeah, but it was in the target next to ours." We got to have the right target to aim for, is what I'm trying to say. All of us would be like Jesus. We know that's the goal. We want to be like Him. But there are others who serve as examples. My friend and I remember back at Challenge Machinery, this was many years ago when we were first starting to get serious about the Lord. And at that time, we were looking around trying to find older men that could help us, that could come alongside us and guide us and work with us. And there were very few. And in all the years since then, I have found very few that have consistently lived the truth and are willing to work with young men and come alongside them and really help them. But the point I'm trying to get at is this passage that we're coming to this morning is probably one of the most outstanding examples of faith in the New Testament. And I can say that with all assurance because Jesus Himself said so. And when Jesus says this is the greatest example of faith, we got to be asking ourselves, who is this guy? Who is this centurion that the Lord Christ Himself would say, "I have not seen such great faith in all the nation of Israel"? Who is this guy? And what were the elements of his faith? And what can we learn from it and make sure that we're growing in the same way? This is to serve as an example for us. So what are the elements of a faith like that that our Lord would say, "I haven't seen such great faith in the entire nation of Israel"? Well, let's pick it up where we left off last time in Matthew chapter 8. And I'll begin in verse 5. Matthew chapter 8, verse 5. When Jesus entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, imploring him and saying, "Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, fearfully tormented." Jesus said to him, "I will come and heal him." But the centurion said, "Lord, I am not worthy for you to come under my roof, but just say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, with soldiers under me, and I say to this one, 'Go,' and he goes, and to another, 'Come,' and he comes. And to my slave, 'Do this,' and he does it." Now when Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who were following, "Truly, I say to you, I have not found such great faith with anyone in Israel. I say to you that many will come from east and west and recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, but the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." And Jesus said to the centurion, "Go. It shall be done for you as you have believed." And the servant was healed that very moment. This morning I want to look at four truths about this centurion's heart. And I want to look at this to impress upon us the importance of right thinking with Jesus. Right thinking is everything. This is an example. And this is one to go to and to think, how did the centurion approach this? And what was he thinking? And what was his heart like? Because it obviously pleased Jesus. In this sense, he's our example. First of all, I want us to consider the attitudes. Consider the attitudes. There's big contrast here. And let's consider the setting. Capernaum was a Jewish town. It was a town with a synagogue and an important exposure to the scriptures. Like any Jewish town, it would have had the law of Moses and all the Old Testament, and the people were schooled in those things. And unlike the leper who came to Jesus to be healed in verse 1 through 4, this centurion was all likelihood a Gentile, and he probably didn't have the advantage of that upbringing. It was likely that he did not come from a background of intense knowledge of the Scriptures, although we do learn from the text that he was a God-fearing man. He came to Jesus, imploring him. It's a strong term. It means to urge or to beg. He came begging. Lord, please. I beg. I urge. I plead with you. It's always good to look at the other accounts, and so I'm getting a lot of my material from Luke chapter 7, which is the parallel account to this one. Luke talks about this in chapter 7, and there he says that this centurion actually had sent some of the Jewish elders, and so this communication was going through the Jewish elders. And so Matthew, it might look to you like it's direct speech, but actually it was being sent through the elders, the Jewish elders. And look at, if you turn that back there with me, we read it earlier this morning, but just look at Luke 7. Probably you want to just keep a marker at both spots because we'll be flipping back and forth quite a bit. Just look at chapter 7, verse 3. When he heard about Jesus, he sent some Jewish elders asking him to come and save the life of his slave. When they came to Jesus, they earnestly implored him, saying, "He is worthy for you to grant this to him, for he loves our nation, and it was he who built our synagogue." They pleaded with him. "He is worthy. Jesus, this is a good man. He is worthy for you to do this miracle for him. He deserves it. He loves our nation. He built our synagogue. If anybody's worthy, surely he is." So what's important is this man is worthy because of what he's done. That's what the Jews are saying. That's why they're pleading on his behalf. But on the other hand, I want us to consider the heart of the centurion himself. There's two things I want us to see here, and the first one is the attitude he had toward his servant. Actually, the term there in here in Matthew is his boy. Could be a boy. Could be a servant also, but primarily that term is used to describe a child or a boy. But in Luke, he calls him a slave. He's both. He was probably a boy, born to one of the slaves in his household, and so he's one of his young male slaves. But this is a different relationship. I mean, it's typical for a master and a slave in this time period to look at their slaves as a tool. One writer put it like this: a slave is a tool like a cart. The only difference is a slave can talk. When you hook your horse to a cart and you use your cart to tote your things around and stuff, well, that's no different than a slave. The master had life and death power over a slave. He didn't like a slave, just kill him and get another slave. He didn't hold him with any kind of value. But we're told in the text that this man, this centurion, had high regard for his slave. He loved his slave. He wants him healed. He's begging on his behalf to be healed. It's a whole different kind of mindset. There's another amazing truth here. If you look at me in verse... Look with me in verse 6. Now the question is, which one? Luke 7, 6 or Matthew? Should have wrote that down. Luke 7. In verse 6, now Jesus started on his way with them, and when he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends saying to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself further, for I am not worthy for you to come under my roof." I mean, all right, think about this with me. Think about it. This man's a centurion. He's no doubt a highly trained soldier. You don't get to be over 100 men in the military if you don't know what you're doing. He was a highly trained soldier. He knew more about soldiering than the guys under him. He was used to giving orders. He was used to taking orders. Highly disciplined man. I'm sure he seems like he would have been somewhat rough. Used to commanding, getting what he wanted. Skilled, over 100 men, used to giving orders. Yet here he says to the Lord Christ, "I'm not worthy for you to come under my roof." and we find out in verse 7, that's why he sent the Jews to go and ask on his behalf, I'm not even worthy to come and talk to you. So what can you say about this guy? His heart is humble toward the Lord. The Jews come bragging, oh, look at all the great things this guy did. He loves our nation. He built us a synagogue. Surely you should heal him. And the centurion saying, I'm not worthy to even talk to you, Jesus. I'm not even worthy for you to come under my roof. It's a big difference in hearts. It's a big difference in attitude. This is more than just the acknowledgement that that Jews coming into a Gentile's home would be defiled. That's Jewish law. There's much more here. He says, just say the word and my servant will be healed. Just say the word and my servant will be healed. All right, when would you ever speak like that? If you had a flat tire out here and you came to me and said, Pastor, would you help me pump out my tire? So, well, yeah, I'll go get my compressor and I'll get an extension cord and we'll pump it up. No, Pastor, just speak the word and I know it'll be so. Never going to happen. We'll go get the air compressor. Right? But not with this centurion. No, Lord. Just speak the word. What is he saying about Jesus? I know you've got the power to speak and will it to be so. The centurion is saying, you're God. You're the Messiah. You're the divine one. You're supernatural. And if you just say the word, it'll be so. Just speak and it'll be done. I know this. Not worthy to talk to you. Just speak and my servant will be healed. He's using Lord in the Old Testament sense of the term. Yahweh, God, Lord. Surely we need to be impressed by this humility of the centurion, his attitude of coming toward the Lord, and his confidence in the Lord's divinity. And that needs to cause us to check our own humility. Secondly, consider this unquestioning belief in Jesus' authority. Back in verse 8 and 9. Let's see, that would be Matthew 8. Next time I'm going to put the book in the chapter, because I just put the verse in here to remind myself, and I went back and forth between the two spots so many times, I don't necessarily know which one I'm talking about. Verse 8 and 9. The centurion said, Lord, I'm not worthy for you to come under my roof, but just say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, with soldiers under me, and I say to this one, go, and he goes, and to another one, come, and he comes, and to my slave, do this, and he does it. A couple years ago, I got my hair cut down here, and the guy was an ex-Navy man, and he said, I had to get out of the Navy. He said, when I went into the Navy 20 years ago, when the officers spoke, we had to do what they said. And now everybody's got their rights, and everybody has to complain. And he says, it's just not being run like the military anymore. Certainly, traditionally, a military is run with a hierarchy of authority, aren't they? When the superior officer says, go, you do it. And you always operate under the last order given, and the highest order from the highest officer goes first. And I mean, they have a whole hierarchy and of how that works, and you just do what he says and you don't question it. He gives orders, he gets the job done. He's saying to Jesus, I know you have the authority, just speak and it's going to be done as you say. As a military officer, he knows what he's talking about. Jesus, you've got the authority, you've got the power. I know, just speak it, it's going to be done for you. You don't have to come to my house, you don't have to touch my servant, you don't have to mix up some special drink for him, or you don't have to do some special thing to put on a show for me. All you got to do is speak and it's going to be done. I know, because you got the authority. You got the power. The centurion did know something about God, didn't he? Remember the creation account? And God said, let there be light, and there was light. God speaks and it happens. God speaks and it happens just like he wills. Deuteronomy 8, chapter 1 through 3, I did a whole semester paper on these three verses, and it's one of the most amazing passages. I'll just read the three verses for you. All the commandments that I'm commanding you today, you shall be careful to do, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land which the Lord swore to give to your fathers. You shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years, that He might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep His commandments or not. He humbled you and let you be hungry and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that He might make you understand that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word, everything that proceeds out of the mouth of God. God let them go hungry, and they grumbled and they complained, but God had a purpose. I'm letting you go hungry so you'll know that everything depends on me and my word. God let them go for 40 years wandering in a wilderness. Their clothes never wore out or anything. And all these miracles happened. Why did He do it? This is one of those passages that He tells you the why behind the scenes, so that you can know that everything is from my mouth. Every command that comes from my mouth is life for you. So anybody that's studied God at all knows that He just speaks and it's done. It's His will. We see Jesus doing the same thing in the miracles and all He did. Remember when they're in a boat, the disciples are the boat is pitching, and I'm told that the Galilee can get up to 10-foot waves sometimes when the winds are circling on it. And here He's pitching in His boat. Jesus is asleep. Lord, we perish. Don't You care? What's He do? Peace, be still. And the whole nature is calm. He speaks. And all of nature instantly responds to His will. And the winds stop, the waves are calm. And, you know, what's the matter with you guys? Don't you have any faith? When God speaks, things happen. Consider this example. That's the mentality, the mindset of this centurion. And this evaluation of that mindset comes right from Jesus. Verse 10. Now when Jesus heard this, He marveled. He marveled and said to those who were following, truly I say to you, I have not found such great faith with anyone in Israel. This unquestioning belief in Jesus was precious in the sight of the Son of God. Jesus said at the end of this gospel, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. God wills. God speaks. Things happen. Believing God and His word is right thinking in Jesus' mind. We need to be impressed by that. We need to recognize that was what Jesus saw in the centurion. Thirdly, now, I mean, we considered the hard attitudes. We considered this unquestioning belief in Jesus' ability. Thirdly, now, let's consider the importance of saving faith. Consider those who have the right pedigree. The externals don't please Jesus. He was not impressed with the fact that the centurion had built a synagogue. He was not impressed at all that the centurion had loved Israel. He was impressed with his faith. That's what Jesus marveled at. Just again, now come with me to verse 11 and 12. But I say to you that many will come from east and west and recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, but the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. I know deep down all of us plan on being at that banquet. We're planning on being in glory with Christ. Every religious system of man has devised some way for people to believe that when they will be the ones that are in the glorious afterlife. And all those other people will be thrown aside. Because they deserve it after all. We don't. Some believe that they will be all right because of their works. We've already seen that Jesus is not impressed with works. Some believe they'll be all right because of their fine pedigree. They believe that because of their heritage, they'll be accepted. If you read through the prophets and you do a detailed study of this, you'll find that that was the attitude of Israel in the day when the Babylonians came. And they're not going to come against us. We have the temple. We got the temple. They're not going to hurt us. God's not going to damage the temple. We're going to be okay. And yet repeatedly in His law, throughout the Bible, God was telling them, "Oh, disobey me, I'll scatter you throughout the earth. I'll wipe the earth clean of you. Scatter you throughout the world." The land, I meant the land of Israel. I'll wipe it clean of you. Scatter you throughout the world. It's not the pedigree. It's not who you have or what you have. It's not that you're a Baptist or a son of a Baptist. It's none of those things that in the deceitfulness of our hearts, people try to cling to those things, our pedigree. God repeatedly told them, "If you don't obey, I'll destroy you, I'll scatter you." Israel refused to listen. But He destroyed it. You understand where Jesus is standing right now in this passage in Capernaum? Luke chapter 10, verse 15, Jesus said, "And you, Capernaum, will not be exalted to heaven, will you? You will be brought down to Hades." He's standing in the midst of an unbelieving city whom He's cursed and will never be rebuilt. And if you go to Capernaum today, basically all it is a bunch of ruins. They might have a few shrines there or something to commemorate Peter's house or something. I'm trying to remember what all's there, but basically nothing. But ruins. Never was rebuilt. What's the difference? On the other hand, those like this pagan Gentile centurion, they believe and trust Jesus. They're the ones that will be at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then just one last thing in verse 12, consider this extreme regret. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Talked about this before, that certainly there's some kind of conscious torment going on there. But don't you think that part of that weeping and gnashing of teeth is simply regret? To see the Lord Christ, to see His kingdom, to see that and to be cast out of it, to be thrown out. That's the most vital question you're ever going to answer in your lifetime. What is that question that's the most vital question that you will ever answer in your lifetime? Simply this: what do you believe about Jesus Christ? Who is Jesus Christ? And what is your response to Him? It's the most important question you'll ever answer in your whole life. Where are you going to be during this banquet that He's talking about, and how do you know? You got to ask yourself some questions, and you got to respond extremely honestly to yourself. Am I going to be in that banquet because I went to the right church, because I prayed a prayer, because I walked in the aisle, because I had the good sense to believe in Jesus? If your attitude is one of, "Well, I did the right thing. I'm a pretty good person." If it all goes back to works, pedigree, and all those other things, you're missing the point. And it's subtle. People can believe that about themselves for years and not really realize what they're even doing. On the other hand, are you going to be at that banquet because of what Jesus did? Jesus died for me. Jesus lived a perfectly righteous life that's credited to my account. Jesus has worked in my heart. Jesus has changed me. Jesus is continually molding and shaping me to be a better man. Jesus, 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 Jesus. It's all about Him and His work. That's the difference. Saving faith is that point in time when you stop trusting in yourself or any act of yourself and begin trusting in Jesus. That's how you know you have saving faith, when that has happened in your heart, when you become conscious of that. We need the faith of the centurion. We need this faith to impress upon us and make sure that our faith is in Christ alone, not anything else. Okay, now fourthly, we looked at heart attitudes. We looked at this unquestioning belief in Jesus. We consider the importance of saving faith. And now fourthly, I want us to consider the immediacy of the healing. Consider the speed of it. Verse 13, "And Jesus said to the centurion, 'Go, it shall be done for you as you have believed.' And the servant was healed that very moment." Speed was immediate. Right now. We saw that back in the leper too, right? In verse 3. "And immediately his leprosy was cleansed." You know, you could almost picture that. This bent over leper and his hands and everything's deformed and all this all over his skin and he sores all over him and everything. And immediately he's cleansed. Amazing. If you had a fever, a horrible sickness, and you guys get that from time to time, and you get these high fevers. When you start getting over it, are you 100% within minutes? No, it can take a day, 2 days, sometimes more to get over it. If you really got a super bad case of pneumonia, it can take weeks to get over it. In these cases, when Jesus healed, it was immediate. It was complete. It was total. So, was this a proportionate healing? Well, my immediate answer is no, absolutely not. But there's a good reason for asking that question. Let's look again at what he says in verse 13. "Jesus said to the centurion, 'Go, it shall be done for you as you have believed.'" The conjunction there is setting up a comparison. In other words, it'll be done for you in proportion to how you believed, or as you have believed, like you believed. And that's how many people take it. So this centurion must have had enough faith to get Jesus to heal the servant completely. All kinds of erroneous doctrines come out of that kind of thinking. And I want to explore that for just a few minutes, because that's really important that we understand what's going on here. In other words, okay, the same way you believe, in that way it's going to be done for you. That's important because so many teach in our day that if only you believe and have enough faith, you can be healthy. If you have enough faith, you can be healed. Many people have left miraculous healing services and were told that they didn't get their miracle because they didn't have enough faith. Sometimes they claim that the healing that they get is only partial. Well, you got a partial healing, but your faith wasn't quite strong enough to get a total healing. Is that the kind of thing we're seeing here? Did it depend totally on the centurion's faith for the healing to happen? You could be free of your cancer if you only had enough faith. Listen, when people tell that, and you know, after you're a pastor for so many years, you run into these things. People get cancer. They get other horrible diseases. They happen even in a small church like ours. People get these kind of things. It's horrible to watch. It's horrible to see them suffer through it. But the worst thing I see, and it really makes me angry, and I got to work on controlling my temper, is when other people will tell them, "You could be free of your disease if you only had enough." Is that true? Can you get better finances and better health from God if you only have enough faith? You just got to believe it so. You got to will it into existence. All right, now if that's true, and if this centurion is the example of faith which Jesus said he was, what elements were present in the centurion's faith so that we can see that in his faith? If it depends on the centurion's faith, I would expect these elements in his heart and his attitude. Did the centurion say, "I know you'll heal my servant Jesus, and I expect it momentarily. I'm sure my servant will be healed. If I just don't doubt it, I'll get what I want." I'm not getting this healing because somebody in my household is doubting. Do you see those elements in the centurion's faith at all? They're not there. They are not there in his thoughts at all. His faith was much better than that. His faith was the highest faith in all of Israel. His faith was a pure faith. I know you can heal him if only you speak the word. What's that conditioned upon? The Lord's will. Lord, if you'll just speak the word, I'll know what'll happen. It's having complete confidence in his ability, but knowing that he's in control of the circumstances and he's going to do what he wants. That's an important detail. We can't will things so. The leper appealed to God's will. We saw that last week. The centurion appealed to God's will. And I don't suggest to you, this is the way it is. Believers today who rest in God's power and might have no less faith than this centurion, even when God says no. You know, if two people are dying of cancer, they're both believers and they both are trusting in Jesus for salvation, and one says, "Oh Lord, I trust you. I'm resting in you. I know you can heal me if you want to." And he gets healed. And the other one goes on and dies. Shall we conclude that the guy that got healed had more faith? Absolutely not. That is diabolical. That is horrible thinking. They both were trusting in God. They both rested in Jesus. They both loved him. It's just one, in the sovereign will of Almighty God, he said, "It doesn't fit my plans and purposes to heal you, my son. I'm going to bring you home." And see, the other one, he said, "Yes, I have more work for you to do. I'm going to heal you." It all depends on God's will, not the man's faith. We are to have faith. But what I mean is, not, we have faith in his ability. We don't exert our will upon his. That's what I'm trying to say. His will is supreme. His will decides. It's all in accordance with his plans and purposes. So be impressed by the need to submit all your wants and desires to God's sovereign will. And that's what we saw in the case of the centurion. That was true faith. Resting in Jesus. "I know, Jesus, you can heal him. Just say it so." So when we come in prayer meeting and various functions of the church and we're asking Jesus to heal people who are sick, that's all right. But sometimes he says no. And that's okay too. Because we know he'll grant us the grace to weather the storm that comes with it when he says no. He said, "Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness and all these other things will be added to you." His plans and purposes have to come first. He's the only one that can see the beginning from the end. He's the only one that can see the whole picture. He knows what has to happen. We don't. This morning we looked at four truths about a centurion's heart to impress the importance of right thinking with Jesus. And the first one was, we got to have the right heart attitude. That centurion was humble. He knew who he was speaking to. And he came with reverence in his heart. And he knew he was unworthy. You know, the writer of Hebrews says that you can come into the very throne room of God and lay your petitions at his feet. And that right was bought for you by Jesus Christ on the cross. That's why you can pray to him. That's why you can bring your petitions to him. Because of Christ's worthiness, not your own. You are not worthy. I had someone tell me that on their deathbed one time, and I wasn't sure how to handle it. I handled it the best way I thought, but they were saying to me, "Pastor, I just don't know if I've done enough." My response was simple. "Listen, we got to settle this right now. You haven't done enough. Don't even think that way. This should have been settled years ago when you turned to Christ. He's the only one that's done enough. Depend on him. Rest on Him. Rest on what He's done on the cross. Everything you did was just out of gratitude for Him. And that's good that you did those things. But it's not enough. So don't even try to think to rest in that. This centurion was humble. He even sent the Jews to talk to Jesus. I'm unworthy to talk to you, Lord. I'm unworthy for you to come to my house. That's how he felt. What about this unquestioning belief in Jesus' power, His authority? Jesus, just speak the word. My servant will be healed. Just whatever comes out of your mouth will be so. Whatever you command is going to happen. I know it. That is confident rest in His ability. Lord, I have a horrible disease. You could take away if you wished. You could heal me of it if you would. I know that. I'm resting in your plans. I know that you're going to do what's right. And I'll accept whatever you decide. That's the right faith. Consider the importance of saving faith. Our works, pedigree, that's not going to make us right with God. Jesus doesn't pay any attention to those things. We trust in Jesus alone, in His work, His what He did on the cross and His righteous life. That's what saves us. Consider also the immediacy of the healing. It was fast, it was total, it was complete. He didn't... Today, people walk up on stage, you know. They pray for Him and they walk off stage. Oh, He's healed! No. That's not right. The healing came not because the centurion believed he would get it. The healing came because Jesus willed it so. Don't forget that. His will is supreme. His purposes are supreme. The centurion, with that faith, had the highest commendation of our Lord, and Jesus would have you have the same kind of faith. Trust in His will. Trust in His ability. Rest in Him. So we have to have the same attitude. So humility, belief that Jesus has the power, trusting in Him alone to save us, and knowing that all things happen according to His greater plan and purpose that only He knows, those are the elements we come away from this and know that that's what pleases Jesus. Well, we'll pick it up, Lord willing, in verse 14 next time. Let's close together in prayer. Our gracious Lord, thank You so much for this lesson from the centurion. Thank You for granting him saving faith, and thank You for giving him a heart that believed in You, and thank You for moving Your apostles to write these things down so we have it preserved for all believers of all centuries. I pray that each one of us would learn from these truths, that we would understand that our God is in heaven. You do whatever You please. I pray that we would rest in that, and that our hearts would be humbled by it, and that we would just rest in Your awesome power. Nothing that happens to us escapes Your knowledge. You know it. Help us to submit to what You bring into our life, and help us to trust in You and rest in You. Lord, help us to have mercy and compassion on others. Thank You. We praise You. In Jesus' name.